Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. House Democrats are moving fast toward impeaching President Trump for what would be an unprecedented second time following last week's deadly riot in the Capitol building by pro-Trump supporters.
Democrats do appear to have the votes in the House to impeach the president before he leaves office in 9 days. But at this point, it still seems unlikely that enough Republicans in the Senate will join Democrats to convict him. Joining us now is Congresswoman Jackie Speier, a Democrat from California. Congresswoman, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Nancy Pelosi is moving to impeach Trump because it doesn't look like Vice President Pence is going to sign on to invoking the 25th Amendment to remove the president. So just walk us through the timeline here. How will this process unfold in the House this week?
So now that the resolution has been introduced, we will be in a position of having a debate on that resolution. And the plan is to actually vote on that resolution on Wednesday.
And one of the questions, of course, is timing. There are some concerns that a Senate trial so early in Joe Biden's new administration would sidetrack his agenda. Yesterday, your Democratic colleague Jim Clyburn of South Carolina called for the impeachment trial to start after Biden's first 100 days in office. So do you support waiting to send the article of impeachment over to the Senate?
I'm certainly willing to consider that option. The actions by the president were criminal. And it is the duty of the House to impeach. If we do not impeach the president because of political concerns, then we have violated our oath, and we have set a precedent for future presidents to conduct themselves in illegal fashions and be allowed to do so. And what you witnessed on the 6th, as members like me were cowering in the gallery of the third floor of the House, we are not going to sit back and allow mob mentality to take over in this country.
And what about your colleagues in the House? I know there are other Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who are calling for invoking the 14th Amendment, which would expel fellow lawmakers who, quote, have engaged in insurrection or rebellion. Are you in favor of expelling those Republicans who voted to decertify the election last week, hours after that riot?
I want them to be reviewed by a court of law. If they have violated their constitutional oath, if they have conducted themselves in a criminal fashion, they deserve due process, and they should be reviewed by a court of law to see if their actions were seditious in nature.
Should they be censured?
You know, censure is an interesting concept, and one that we move too quickly invoke. But I don't know if censure is enough, frankly. If this was an illegal act, then it should be reviewed by a court of law, and they should be convicted of the crime.
I saw you tweet recently that the Air Force medals that were given to one of the rioters who was seen inside the House chamber with zip ties as if he planned to start taking hostages. I know you've called for those medals to be taken away. And you've also called for an independent commission to investigate the security breach. What questions do you have? What do you want to investigate? And what is the first thing a commission should do?
Well, the commission I see as being independent, made up of professionals that will look at our institution from the outside. So much like the 9/11 Commission, you know, I think one of the ultimate questions that has to be asked is, because the District of Columbia does not have statehood and is reliant on the D.C. National Guard being authorized by the Department of Defense, does that put our nation at risk? It certainly put the Congress at risk last Wednesday.
You referred to you and your colleagues cowering inside the Capitol building last Wednesday, and it reminds us, and as if you needed reminding, that in 1978, you were shot 5 times in the country of Guyana on a trip with your boss, Congressman Leo Ryan, who was killed. You were trying to rescue members of the Jonestown cult. I know that was a terribly traumatic experience. Do you see parallels when you look back at what happened to you last week?
You know, 2 years ago, I wrote my memoir called Undaunted. And when I was on the book tour, I got this question over and over again, which was, do you see parallels between Jim Jones and Donald Trump? And at first, I was, you know, reluctant to make that parallel. But as time has gone by, the parallels are quite stark. I mean, you have, in one case, a religious cult, in another one, a political cult that is also wrapped in a religiosity of sorts. So I would say that there are indeed parallels.
Congresswoman Jackie Speier, Democrat from California, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
The coronavirus surge continues around the country. Today, Arizona is among the hardest-hit states, reporting more than 11,000 new cases and 105 deaths on Sunday. It's also setting daily records for COVID-19 patients hospitalized, 4,988. That's 1,500 more than at the peak of the summer surge. California, Florida, Oklahoma, and Rhode Island are also struggling. We'll check in on California a little later. All of this is playing out as the bottlenecked national vaccine rollout continues. 6.7 million Americans have now received a single dose. 22 million doses have been distributed to hospitals and pharmacies. Let's bring in Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University's Coronavirus Resource Center. Dr. Nuzzo, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
We want to get to vaccines, of course, but before we do, could you just give us a snapshot of the country on this Monday? You know, we just mentioned Arizona. Where do you see the country over the next few weeks? And are we yet seeing a surge from New Year's gatherings?
We continue to see a worrisome increase in both the case numbers as well as the deaths across the United States. You know, in the last week or so, the first week of January, the U.S. reported its highest number of cases and deaths ever recorded since the beginning of the pandemic. And so that's a really worrisome situation to be in. We now are seeing that the U.S. adds about a million cases every 4 days or so. So it's a really remarkable pace at which the case numbers and then the deaths that follow are accelerating. So this is very worrisome. This is something that we're seeing in nearly half of all states, and it's really sort of scattered throughout the country. It's not limited to any particular region. And what worries me most is that we are yet to see the full effects of the holiday gathering. Some of this is clearly attributable to that, but you know, it could be some weeks before we truly see the full impacts.
And so this, of course, underscores the urgency of getting the vaccine out there. And so I want to get to that. You know, President-elect Biden is saying that he wants to shift gears and not initially hold back half the vaccine doses for booster shots. Instead, he wants to vaccinate as many as people with first doses. But it seems like there's some confusion about this, Dr. Nuzzo. So hopefully you can clarify. He's not saying he doesn't want people to get that second dose, right? What is he saying?
Right. That's exactly right. What they're saying is that we're not going to, if you vaccinate one person, take another dose and put it back in the freezer, waiting for that person to get to the point where the second dose will be administered. Instead, focus on giving everybody their first dose, but expecting full well to be able to administer the second dose given supply projections. I think it's a reasonable approach given how slowly the vaccine has been rolling out. And, you know, given I think fairly good estimates of vaccine supplies. It's not entirely clear, but I think it's a reasonable approach at this point. And you know, really, I think the emphasis is on getting as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible. But
we
should not assume that this means that people are not going to get their second dose.
Sure, sure. And it does put some pressure on those manufacturers to make sure they meet those deadlines for the second doses. And to that end, Dr. Nuzzo, you know, some people are calling for a mass vaccination strategy. So instead of vaccinating in phases that are determined by age, exposure, and pre-existing conditions, you know, Dr. Jonathan Reiner, for example, said on CNN this morning that we should do away with this priority system because vaccinating anyone protects everyone. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think that there is some value in thinking about how we should be pulling off a mass vaccination campaign. I'm not yet convinced that we are at that point. I think the need right now is to make sure that we protect our healthcare workers because they're the ones who are going to be running any kind of mass vaccination clinic. I think we will quickly soon have to switch to other age brackets. And at that point, I think a mass vaccination campaign might be warranted. But that's a completely different logistical challenge than what we've been seeing now. And so that requires separate planning. And that requires, in my particular concern is personnel. And we need to figure out where we're going to get these personnel from, because the people who are able to administer vaccines, many of them have day jobs that we very much need right now to deal with rising hospitalizations and the COVID cases. So I don't think it's just a simple, we can just flip a switch and get there. We need to very much to be planning and thinking about what the requirements are. But I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that at some point we're going to see that.
Well, let me ask you then about a sort of an ambitious benchmark that President-elect Biden has set. He wants to achieve 100 million vaccinations in the first 100 days that he's in office. Do you think he can hit that?
It's an ambitious goal. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. It will require political will. It will require resources. But, you know, I hope we don't overpromise what can be done.
All right. That's Jennifer Nuzzo. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland. Dr. Nuzzo, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
The Trump administration has missed another deadline for the 2020 census. Yesterday was the last day for President Trump to deliver a report to Congress. It was supposed to include the latest state population counts and the number of House seats each state gets for the next decade. But the Census Bureau says it needs more time to check the accuracy of its results. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang covers all things census-related, and he joins us now from New York to explain what all this means. Hey, Hansi.
Hey, Peter.
So the last time you were on the show, he reported on a year-end census deadline that was missed. At this point, when are we going to get these results?
It's looking like February 9th at the earliest. And again, we're talking about the first set of census results. Those are the new state population counts used to determine how many House seats, as well as Electoral College votes, each state gets for the next 10 years. But those numbers may not be ready until after February 9th, because the Census Bureau recently found more irregularities in the census records. That's a normal part of the census process, because it's always complicated and messy when you're trying to gather information about every person living in the country. But what's not been normal is the pandemic and the Trump administration making last-minute schedule changes. That's really thrown off the timing here and forcing census deadlines to be missed.
Right. I mean, time is running out for the Trump administration here, just days left in the administration. And I know you've been tracking the president's push to exclude unauthorized immigrants from those first set of census numbers. Do you think the president will be able to do that, given the timing here?
At this point, no. It's looking increasingly unlikely. The Census Bureau is not even at the last stage of processing those census records. And, you know, there's a handoff process for certifying those numbers, and President Trump has been preparing to disrupt that process. But this timing right now means that it will be likely the Biden administration overseeing the handoff. And President-elect Joe Biden has condemned President Trump's plan, Biden has emphasized that no resident of the U.S. should be excluded from these census numbers because of their immigration status. And we have to keep in mind the 14th Amendment requires the, quote, whole number of persons in each state, unquote. And so for now, all signs point to a relatively uneventful handoff that ends with the clerk of the House of Representatives eventually certifying each state's number of House seats before reporting them to the governors at some point later this year.
Well, Joe Biden has named his pick for the cabinet secretary who would oversee the Census Bureau, and that is someone who could play a pretty key role in that handoff of census results. What are we learning?
We're talking about the governor of Rhode Island, Gina Raimondo, a Democrat, former state treasurer in Rhode Island, the first woman to lead the state. And if she is confirmed as the next Commerce Secretary by the Senate, she would oversee the Census Bureau and play an important role in the 2020 Census, because it is the Commerce Secretary who is supposed to report those first set of results to the president to start this handoff process.
And what do we know so far about the kind of priorities that Governor Raimondo would have as the new supervisor of the Census Bureau?
You know, not much. It's not clear what Governor Raimondo's current thinking is around the census. I've put in a request for comment to the Biden transition team. Haven't heard back yet. Governor Raimondo has spoken out against that citizenship question that the Trump administration failed to add to the 2020 census. She's also emphasized the importance of getting an accurate census because it affects how much federal funding states like Rhode Island get for the next 10 years. But Raimondo didn't make a single reference to the census or the Census Bureau last week during her first speech since being named as Biden's pick for Commerce Secretary. Raimondo focused a lot more on the Commerce Department spurring job creation, possibly under the Biden administration. But the thing to keep in mind is that the Commerce Department's name is misleading. It's an eclectic group of agencies at the department. And the bulk of the work at the Commerce Department is at the Census Bureau and also the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA.
Right.
So the Commerce Department's bread and butter are really survey data and weather reports.
Huh. And so we wait. When we finally do get these results from the census that we've been talking about, is that the end of the process? What happens next?
No, we're also waiting for the second set of census results. That's the more detailed demographic data that states need for the redrawing of voting districts. It's still not clear when that data will be ready because we don't even know when the first set of results will be out. So counting is finished at this point, but the 2020 census, even though it's 2021, will not be over for a while.
The strangeness of this year and last year continues. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang, our guide to all things census. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Peter.
Let's go to California now, where hospitals are overflowing with COVID-19 patients as the post-holiday impacts are materializing. In Los Angeles County, over the past week, an average of more than 200 people were dying per day. So the extraordinary step of rationing care is now closer to becoming a reality. Dr. Arun Patel is overseeing the triage program for public hospitals in LA County. He joins us now. Dr. Patel, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So I know we're not there yet, Dr. Patel, but how close do you think LA County is to activating healthcare rationing at this point?
We're pretty close. We're struggling. We're definitely at higher census, have more patients in the hospitals than anyone can remember. And we're definitely deep into contingency care, not only for our hospitals, but for every hospital in the region. And so people are making space for additional ICU beds. They're putting beds in places in units or wards that they don't usually put them in. We've hired more nurses from outside. We've shifted nurses from some of our outpatient clinics to inpatient work. So we're at the point where we're stretching a lot, but we're not at the point of having to make those really awful decisions yet, and I hope we never get there.
In the past, Dr. Patel, we might have seen these kinds of measures in sort of an acute emergency. This seems more like a slow boil. So what would be the bar for actually reaching a crisis level?
When we get to the point where we have to actually make decisions about giving a resource to patient A or patient B because we simply don't have enough. You know, we may be talking about equipment like ventilators or dialysis machines or oxygen flow setups, or we could be talking about staff like nurses or respiratory therapists or, you know, in extreme cases, potentially doctors.
So are there other states or countries that have already had to do this that you can use as a guide?
There are certainly other countries and states that we think have been in similar positions. Certainly Italy, New York in the late spring looked like it was in a similar state. So we certainly learned some lessons from looking at what happened there and have tried to adjust and predict what may happen here.
I imagine that's helpful, but I mean, what can really prepare you for what can be potentially agonizing decisions? I mean, can you take us inside a hospital and describe who's going to actually be making these decisions about who gets life-saving care and who doesn't?
So we have groups of doctors that we refer to as triage officers. And so each hospital will have a triage officer that is on duty at any time. All of them have some background or training in medical ethics, and we also make sure that they have some training in implicit bias, which, of course, is something that people are very aware of these days. And we also do a lot of tabletop and sort of practice exercises with them so that we go through scenarios and say, what do you do next? What information do you need? So we kind of walk them through the scenario to get them to think about the question you just asked me, which is, how are you going to do this in real time?
Yeah, I mean, there's all those scenarios that you can game out, but I mean, how would you actually have that conversation, Dr. Patel? I mean, can you put yourself in the shoes of having to tell a patient or a patient's family, I'm sorry, but we're not going to continue to treat you, or we're not going to treat your mother?
This is a very, very difficult conversation. And I think one thing that it's really important to highlight here, Cal, is that we have the triage officers in part so we can separate the functions of caring for the patient and making hard decisions about care. So when a decision like this is made, we think that it's probably best for the patient's attending physician to have that conversation with them, because they're the one that already has a relationship with them. We don't want someone sort of swooping in and delivering terrible news. We hope it's someone who already has a rapport with the patient or the family.
In the moment that we have left, Dr. Patel, what do you hope people living in other states will learn from the COVID-19 situation in Los Angeles?
That even though we have a vaccine, even though we have been doing this for almost a year now, we're not out of the woods. And so people still need to be mindful. They still need to wear their masks when they're around folks they don't live with. They still need to try to avoid contact with people they don't live with as much as they can. And they need to social distance as much as they can. We still have to work at this until enough people have been vaccinated, which will probably still take a few months before we can let our guard down.
Dr. Arun Patel is overseeing the triage program for public hospitals in Los Angeles County. Dr. Patel, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
The world was shocked when pro-Trump extremists stormed and seized the U.S. Capitol. Throughout this tumultuous era, the NPR Politics podcast has been there every day explaining and making sense of the news. We'll be doing that through the final days of the Trump administration as we all try to understand how this moment happened and what will come next.
Two health crises will confront President-elect Joe Biden when he takes office on January 20th, the coronavirus pandemic, and the opioid epidemic. The addiction crisis has taken a backseat to COVID-19 since spring, but it hasn't gone away. The number of overdose deaths nationwide was growing in the months before the pandemic, and according to the Centers for Disease Control, the surge has only accelerated since then. WCPN's Nick Castell reports that treatment providers in Northeast Ohio hope Biden will make the addiction crisis a top priority.
At Stella Maris, a nonprofit addiction recovery center on Cleveland's west side, as many as 200 people can be on the wait list for detox. And when a client's number comes up, Daniel Lettenberger Klein, the center's director, says there's a short but important window of opportunity.
Literally, it is choosing between life and death, coming into treatment or not. And if somebody's willing at that moment when they call, there's no guarantee that when we call them back 2 days later, when we have a bed for them, that they're still willing.
As the CEO of the Ohio Association of County Behavioral Health Authorities, Sherry Walter represents agencies that fund substance recovery efforts. She says Biden's coronavirus task force needs to consider how the pandemic complicates the opioid crisis, leaving people to face their addictions in isolation.
When you talk about mental illness and addiction, you're kind of talking about those issues of despair. More people are losing their jobs. They can't see their families.
Many treatment providers credit the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion with allowing people to afford recovery services, especially adults without children. They want the new administration to ensure that Medicaid remains well-funded. And Walter hopes Biden will go further, expanding the types of services eligible for Medicaid reimbursement.
In the best of all worlds, we'd love to be able to see Medicaid cover room and board for people who are in residential treatment.
Providers also want Biden to keep a campaign promise to enforce parity laws, requiring insurers to cover addiction recovery to the same degree they cover other health procedures. Beyond federal rules, federal spending is necessary because states can't go it alone, says Ohio University Associate Professor Dan Skinner.
I would assume that that's one of the lessons that the Biden administration is going to learn about a number of things, especially COVID, but the opioid crisis as well, that to convince states to take action, you need to offer support. States can't bankroll some of these huge health crises.
Biden could also invest in rural internet connections, Skinner says, helping recovery centers use telemedicine to reach people in need who live far from help.
If you're in Columbus or Cincinnati or Cleveland or, you know, one of the other major cities, there are pretty good services and supports that have been put into place over the last few years. But if you're living in a rural area, you likely do not have that same kind of capacity.
Treatment providers are already experimenting with telemedicine during the pandemic, forcing them to balance coronavirus precautions with the social connection that's necessary for people in recovery. The stress of isolation has some worrying that providers and the federal government may see a post-COVID surge in people seeking help with substance use disorder. Even so, Sherry Walter says help is still available.
There are all kinds of places you can get help right now. I think one of the things people think is a lot of, you know, doctor's offices and so forth, they've ratcheted back what they're doing. The recovery system is still open in the state of Ohio.
And it will be open on January 20th when a new administration confronts a crisis that has gripped the country for years. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Castell in Cleveland.
The Trump administration is in turmoil in its final days, but the federal government is still planning to execute three more people before Trump leaves office. Lisa Montgomery murdered a pregnant woman in Kansas in 2004 in a nightmarish effort to steal the unborn fetus. Montgomery is scheduled to die tomorrow. She'd be the 11th federal inmate executed since July after the Trump administration ended a 17-year hiatus on capital punishment. No president has rushed to execute this many prisoners in a year since the 1880s. This bell tolled in protest before an execution in August. Joining us now is Sister Helen Prejean, a Catholic nun and an anti-death penalty activist. Sister Helen, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, really glad to be here.
Sure. And the federal government still wants to proceed with three executions this week, even now as the president is facing another impeachment. What kind of statement do you think that makes?
Well, this is part of President Trump's overall approach to the way he tries to hold power, is to use violence. He upholds white supremacy groups, people who use violence. He encouraged the group to storm the Capitol. And see, executions are just part of his whole way of doing things. It's like when you want law and order, in quotes, you show force, you use violence to get your will. What it's really showing to me, because I've been involved with this death penalty issue for 30 years, I've witnessed six executions, and I've studied it and looked at the way the Supreme Court set it up. It was flawed from the beginning. It was flawed because they have an impossible criteria. It's supposed to be only for the worst of the worst, but overwhelmingly its practice has been if you kill white people. The discretion's given over to prosecutors to do or not. We are executing all these people under Trump because he has the will to kill people. And so he says, set it in motion and you can kill. It's at his discretion after 17 years of a hiatus.
I do wonder if you could help us understand what might be ahead in the next couple of days. Lisa Montgomery is scheduled to be put to death tomorrow, as I said. But late last week, a federal judge in Indiana ruled that before that execution and the two others could happen, more has to be done to prevent COVID-19 from spreading at the federal prison in Terre Haute, where the executions would take place. What is the latest on this? You know, because sometimes these can go up to the very last minute. Do you expect these executions to go forward?
Sadly, I have to say I do. I don't think they care a whit about other people getting infected. They're so intent on carrying out these executions. I mean, the pandemic, I mean, hundreds of people come into Terre Haute. They don't care a whit about that. They care only about, we're going to kill this woman. And oh, Peter, it is so especially tragic of the killing of Lisa Montgomery. I mean, she was traumatized. She was tortured. And now they want to kill her. And then when you look at what happened at her trial, where the prosecutor said abuse excuse, and she didn't have the defense she needed. She didn't have the experts to be able to show her story of trauma and what led her to do that, as you call it, a nightmarish act. That's the act of a crazy person. I mean, it's so horrible what's happening. I can't tell you how much I'm anguished over this.
Well, Sister Helen, I hear you, and I know you think about this as well, the pain of the victims' families and what they're feeling right now and what they've been feeling for years because of the murders. I mean, people would say that death would be justice for Lisa Montgomery because of what she did. And I don't know if you've met with her or what you can tell us about that, but there are plenty of people who are listening to this who think it was horrendous what she did.
Exactly. It's horrendous what she did, but we have to look at ourselves as a society and how we're going to respond to it. I have met many, many victims' families over the year. It's been bogus from the beginning that the death penalty was framed in a context, we're going to do this for the victim's family. Do you know they have a script to read at the federal executions of what the victim's families are supposed to say? About thank you, now I feel closure, all this kind of stuff. How can they're witnessing a violence against this woman and have her be killed in front of their eyes possibly heal their hearts of their loss? It's just a big lie, and it's the final thing prosecutors try to do to say what we're really doing is honoring the victim's family.
Have you had a chance to meet with Lisa Montgomery in her final days?
No, not directly. I've been working closely with her lawyers and the people who are trying to plead her case. And you want to hear something terrible, Peter. Her clemency petition has to be in the hands of Trump. Will he even be able to attend to her plea? That's why you cannot put in the hands of individuals this discretion of life or death that they carry. You don't have an execution if prosecutors do not deliberately seek it. And her clemency petition is sitting in the midst of that chaos in the White House. Will he even look at it? I doubt it.
I'm speaking with Sister Helen Prejean, the anti-death penalty activist, ahead of what has been a sprint from the Trump administration to execute federal prisoners before the end of his term. And the end of this term is coming, whether it's through impeachment or forced removal or whether just Joe Biden gets inaugurated on January 20th. He has said that he would end federal executions. Joe Biden has. He's also a Catholic. What do you expect from the new president on this issue?
I expect he's going to do exactly what he said. And he said that he's going to end federal executions and he's going to do it. And look at the vagaries and arbitrariness and capriciousness of this. Here, January 12th, and here Biden comes in on the 20th. 8 more days and she would live. Oh, God, it's just awful. And I just grieve it. And we have to just wake up the people. People are sickened by the violence they have seen going on in the Capitol, of the Capitol Police smashed against doors and people killed. But see, we will not see her killing. And that's the big thing that I maybe have tried to serve is I've been a witness. I witnessed executions. I came out and my job has been to wake up the American people. This is what is being done in your name and why I wrote Dead Man Walking and why I stay in public discourse to wake up the people.
I hear you talking, and I think that regardless of where anyone stands on a political spectrum on this issue, there is so much pain in this country right now on so many fronts. And I know that you're facing your own pain, personal pain, because of the pandemic. Your younger brother, Lewis, died recently, I understand. I hope you don't mind me asking you about this. Just wonder if you might be able to share how you're doing in this difficult time.
Thank you, Peter. No, I'm doing all right. Louis, my little brother, he had a merciful death because he was in a medically induced coma. So he slipped over in his sleep into the arms of God on the other side, and I'm very grateful about that. But by neglect and by not having a national strategy, we have the killing of so many American people. It's unspeakable. We can't even get our minds around the statistics of over 300,000 people dead. So the active taking of the life of Lisa Montgomery is one thing, and the passive or through neglect of allowing the death of so many citizens is another aspect of the violence of this administration and Trump.
So you are a person who turns to God for comfort in times like this. And I know many people do as well. And many people might wonder, I wonder if your faith has been tested in the last year or so.
Yeah, I want to say, my God, my living God, has that divine spark in my heart that it's my job to do God's work. And God's work in the world is compassion, not vengeance. God's work in the world is justice. God's an active verb. God is not this supreme being out there removed from everything. God sparks us to life and to work for justice.
And are you saying that spark has not dimmed at all for you recently?
No, the spark is alive. I wrote a book called River of Fire. It's about awakening. It's about how I, as a Catholic nun, who used to just pray for people, ask God to help them, realize that God's saying, you roll up your sleeves, you let me and you, the God of life, get out there and get involved. So that's me. That's God in me. And it's actually that divine spark is in everybody, whether you go to church or not, whether you even say you believe in God or not. Where's the spark and what are you doing with your life?
Sister Helen Prejean, Catholic nun, anti-death penalty activist, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Peter. Great talking to you.
JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Citigroup are pausing political contributions to both Republicans and Democrats in the wake of the riot at the Capitol last week. Other companies, including Marriott International and Blue Cross Blue Shield, the insurance group, say they are stopping donations to Republican lawmakers who supported efforts to block the certification of President-elect Joe Biden's win. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hey there, Jill.
Hello.
So could you start by just helping us understand how businesses generally go about raising money for political action committees? How does this process work?
First, let me also start with a disclosure that my life partner is involved in one of these big bank PACs. So just want to make sure that's out there. I don't know anything about it except what was reported in the news. So she's very good at keeping
secrets. We appreciate
that. That's good. So these political action committees allow companies to sidestep the federal laws that prohibit them from giving money directly to the candidate. So they do is they go out and they say to their employees, hey, everyone, would you like to voluntarily, we're not shaking you down, but would you voluntarily give some money up to $5,000 to a candidate per election, as well as $15,000 annually to any national party? Now, historically, these corporate PACs, they've given to both Republican and Democratic candidates. They want to play both sides of the aisle so that they can promote policies and regulations that favor their companies and their industry. So that's the basic framework.
Well, considering how many people these large companies we just ticked off employ, this is not an insignificant number of people. So what are the implications then of these businesses pausing political fundraising, at least for the time being?
Well, I think that money-wise, if it's a temporary halt, it's not that big a deal, right? But it does say so much because money talks. And if these companies are going to start to put policies and procedures in place where they hold some of the politicians accountable for their actions, then this could have a more long-lasting impact, at least from the corporate giving standpoint.
Okay, so money talks, and if we listen to what the companies are talking about, JP Morgan, for example, the largest bank in the country, says that it is stopping political donations for 6 months to focus on the nation's health and economic crises. But those crises are not new, Jill, so interpret the talking here for us. I mean, does this indicate that banks are treading lightly so as to not alienate lawmakers in either party?
You know, I can't get in the head of Jamie Dimon, but I thought that was a pretty wimpy statement. That's my editorial part of this. I don't think it's about alienation so much, but I do think they want to create and they want to stick to a process that's going to allow them to make consistent decisions across party lines, because you don't want to be accused to say, oh, you just are punishing Republicans because you don't like Republicans. You want to put something in place that will allow you to create giving policies going forward. Now, look, some companies, like you mentioned, Marriott, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Commerce Bank, Morgan Stanley, they're putting the line in the sand right now. They're saying we are not giving money to anyone who opposed the Electoral College certification of President-elect Biden. Now, others are just kind of taking a time out on their PAC giving. And as you said, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Ford, AT&T. But that may have more to do with just creating a policy that they can be held to for themselves and also be able to say to shareholders and to the public, this is what our policy is.
So there's a lot of different industries making moves here. We're hearing now that after banning President Trump from its platform, Facebook is also suspending its political contributions. Could we see other social media companies follow suit, Jill?
Well, I wonder, you know, Facebook not exactly, or Twitter for that matter, profiles encourage when it comes to these matters, but they are now kind of healing to the environment. Microsoft also said that they're going to pause their political giving until to assess the implications of last week's events. I think also it's important, with, at least with these social media companies, they've got to worry about their own legal problems arising from antitrust allegations from the government. We know that they all beefed up their lobbying efforts. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out amid a new administration in light of the events of last week.
So, Jill, help us put this in context then. I mean, these recent decisions come in the midst of many corporations working to better disclose or in some cases even limit political contributions. So how does the response now compare to what we saw just recently with Black Lives Matter protests over the summer?
Well, I mean, this is very – I think that the response from corporate America over the last decade has really changed dramatically. You know, even if I go back – you know, when I first got into the business in the late 80s, companies would basically shut up and, like, not get involved in anything. There was no conscience at all. But over the last decade, and this probably started around the marriage equality fights state by state and then nationally – and it really did expand with a lot of companies signing on to an amicus brief protecting rights. And after Black Lives Matter, I think the corporate PR response was huge. Now, whether they follow through or not is unclear, but here's a real positive aspect of this. There does seem to be real traction internally for companies to improve their hiring policies and expand their pipelines to attract people of color and to have better policies for their employees. And some of this is really kind of cool because there's a greater sense of accountability. Thank goodness for activist employees. And don't forget, those ESG investors, they want better governance. So I think this could be a good sea change.
Well, we know that you'll be watching to see whether they follow through. That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.